Good evening. Tonight is our last session. Is our last session for the course, White House Communications from the Perspective of Officials and Reporters. And tonight we have photographers. Two photographers from the White House, Charles O'Maney of Newsweek and Brooks Kraft of Time, who have been competitors and friends since the 2000 election. And so each of them are going to show pictures, and they'll probably comment on each other's work. And we'll talk about how they do their work. And one of the aspects that we're going to look at are the public and private aspects of the presidency. And Brooks is going to show us a series of photographs that he did, of pictures he took at the Bush Ranch one morning during, was it Christmas vacation?
Yes.
Uh-huh. And Charles is going to show us some pictures that he took on the campaign trail, on the bus, following the bus last week.
Yeah, right. Just 24 yeah. hours.
First, let's talk about how you both got into the business, how you became photographers, what kind of background you had coming to the White House for your news organizations.
I started in newspapers while I was in college. I went to a liberal arts college, Wesleyan University, and ended up spending a lot more time working at the Hartford Courant than I did at Wesleyan University. I was freelancing during the evening, especially during the evenings and the weekends, and just started doing more and more of that, and worked at several newspapers coming out of college, and actually became photo editor of a small newspaper up in Massachusetts, in Holyoke, Massachusetts. But I became increasingly frustrated with the news, just the way newspapers operate, which is basically, for a photographer anyhow, you do 2, 3, 4, 5 things a day. You're running around, you spend 5 minutes taking a picture, then you're off to do something else. And they also, you know, newspapers tend to have a very literal approach to news. Mm-hmm. It's very, very content oriented. So the combination of just feeling kind of fragmented, and also I felt like the style of photography was I was interested in something that was a little bit more interpretive, mm-hmm. a little bit more creative, a little bit less literal. After about 3 or 4 years in newspapers, I went out freelance. And a lot of freelance photographers work through agencies. There's a whole system of agencies that operate out of New York and Paris that basically act as like giant syndication services for magazines around the world. That's how a lot of magazines get their images from agencies. So I started working through agencies, and then after that developed relationships at some of the magazines, and around 96 hooked up with Time and became a contributing photographer there. And at the time, I was living in Boston, and one of the main things that happens up in New England is the New Hampshire primary. So I did a lot of political coverage. Mm-hmm. And in this business, you sort of get—it's very hard to—you get pigeonholed, you know, as a political photographer, or as a portrait photographer, or as a war photographer. I started out sort of by chance, just because it was sort of a national. A national news type thing that was happening in my backyard, and I started shooting politics, and been doing it for about 10 years now.
Uh-huh. That's very interesting. In looking at newspapers, when you were doing the newspaper photography, would you go from any kind of story, like would they send you out to take pictures of the mayor, and then take you, you know, send you out to a school, just mm-hmm. to a variety of things, so that the only thing that was in common was that you were taking pictures?
Yeah, you go, in a way it's really attractive. I mean, if you think about it, because you can go from shooting sports to shooting the mayor to doing a portrait to just taking a nice picture out at a lake or on the beach. Uh-huh. But I found the reality was that I was just constantly running.
Uh-huh.
And now, of course, I'm constantly running at the White House, but at least I'm constantly running in one environment.
Yeah.
So, you do. Uh-huh. You do sort of jump from one thing to the other. And the other thing, which was a factor for me, was in newspapers, there's kind of a ceiling. You know, there are a few newspapers in the country that are doing just phenomenal photojournalism, and have really, really talented staffs. But there's only a handful. And at the time that I was really getting into the business, it was actually very, very hard. Newspapers were, through the 70s and the 80s, were predominantly white and male. Mm-hmm. And it was very hard to get a job if you were a white male in newspapers. I mean, it was virtually impossible for good reason. They were trying to diversify that. Mm-hmm. So there was, for me, there was also economic things pushing me away from, because at the time, I didn't see any way that I could get the kind of newspaper job that I wanted. I mean, there are newspapers out there that cover their regions, the nation, mm-hmm. and the world in a really neat and interesting way. Mm-hmm. But it didn't seem it didn't seem possible for me at the time.
Uh-huh. Charles, can you tell us how you got into it?
Well, as you'll find out, I'm not nearly as serious as Brooks, but. But and our stories consequently are a little different. But I got into this game because the only place I could smoke at school was the dark room, and I of course could lock the door and tell the master that he couldn't come in because I was developing film, and we had a fan in there, so that was my start. And I consequently went on to be the director of photography at the school.
combustible.
No, I had no chemicals out at all.
I
didn't even have a roll of film. I just had a packet of Marlboro Lights. But anyway, so that's how I got into it. But I woke up one day and I was 21 years old. I was just out of college. I'd done nothing to do with photography, but always had a love of it. And
where was the college?
I was at Edinburgh University. Uh-huh. in Scotland, and I'm English, as you can probably tell. I woke up one day after doing a fine art degree, which turned into a general, actually, in the second year, but that's another story, and wasn't really sure what I was going to do. I had traveled a little bit in Australia and Asia, and I knew I loved photography, and it was literally a wake-up call that I was broke and approaching 22 years old. My father was on my case, you know, what are you going to do with your life and all that kind of stuff. And I was, what are the two things I enjoy doing syndrome was going on. And I knew I loved photography and I liked traveling. So I was literally, what two things could have, as a job, could involve those. And started working as a postman, which is a god-awful job, and involves getting up at 3:45 in the morning and being chased by all manner of dogs.
But you can smoke the whole time.
I smoked. And I wore...
In fact, you could flick the butts of the dogs.
Do you know what I did? It was so damn cold in the west of England where I was a bloody postman that I used to wear a fur hat from Russia. And I only found out after I'd been doing this wretched job for 6 months that it was the fur bloody hat that was causing all the dogs to go after me. But anyway, cut a long story short, I saved up enough money in about 7 months and bought an old, I'll never forget it because it was the most wonderful thing I'd always dreamt about having one of these Nikon F2s, which is the camera that Dennis Hopper had in Apocalypse Now. Now, it probably means nothing to a lot of you, but it was a big deal to me. Dennis Hopper and a black F2, coolest thing since sliced bread. Anyway, so I bought this camera, and I bought it from a little camera shop in Bath in the west of England, and saved up another 3 months. And when I was growing up, I won't take too long, but when I was growing up, I used to go on holiday to a place called Corfu in Greece. Oh, yeah. It's a little island in the Aegean off the coast of Greece, and mainland Greece. And when we used to sit on the beach, my father always used to point to this land, this very dark, kind of about 30 miles off the coast, this very dark mountainous landscape. And he used to say, you know, you never want to go over there. That's a bad place. And this was, of course, in the 70s when Hoxha was ruling Albania. And this was Albania, which was this kind of very mysterious and unpleasant place. Certainly that's what people thought. Mm-hmm. And no one knew anything about it. And, it was off limits. And, if you took your fishing boat too close or your dinghy or whatever you were in too close, you would never be seen again. And so the first thing I intended to do as soon as I had enough money was go to Albania. This was in 1991, and it's September of 1990, and I bought myself a return ticket to Tirana, and I won't go into the whole story, but what got me into this game, really, was myself and this little Nikon F2, actually, it was bloody heavy, but anyway, I went over to Albania. I didn't have a clue about photojournalism. I really didn't. I liked taking pictures, and it was as basic as that. And this was a passion of mine. And I happened to meet...
Did you have the appropriate papers to get into Albania?
Yeah, I had. I had a visitor, 2-week visitor's visa, but nothing official. And certainly in those days, it was a real fluke. But I got into Albania. I had this. It was a sham that I got in. But I met as soon as I got there, because there were so few European inverted commas journalists around, and I loved the idea of thinking that I was a journalist. I met this guy. I never forget him. He's a guy called Adrian Brown, who I years later ended up working with in Sarajevo. But I met this young guy, a stringer for the Daily Telegraph newspaper in England, and we both said, well, let's go and try and get a story published. And he was, he was as new at this game really as me, a little bit more established, but he was a stringer. So he was kind of like the bottom of the rung of the freelance world. And the two of us had enough guts in those days. I think we were, how you are when you're young, you're kind of fearless. We went to the Interior Ministry in Tirana, and I won't use this swear word, but we basically BS'd the Interior Ministry that the two of us were from Shell and that we were geologists and we needed to go to the north of the country, which is forbidden, a place called Bulqiza in the north of Albania, near the border with Kosovo, and we needed to go down into the chromium mines because we believed that there was oil in the chromium mines, and this could be a huge investment for the Western governments to invest in Albania as it was opening up. And they fell for it.
How did you come up with that story?
Absolutely on the fly. didn't think about it 10 minutes before. They gave us the passes. Can you believe it? Gave us the necessary passes, and the two of us got up to this place called Bulqiza. Now, Bulqiza is where all the political prisoners were kept, and that's where they used to mine. Well, totally off limits. I mean, no journalists, and no real journalists, had ever been into this place. It was completely off limits. And lo and behold, and I'll end the story there, there's lots of adventures, nearly died and all this rest of it, but the two of us were the first Western journalists, and I say that journalists, to document the political prisoner mines in the north of Albania. And we got out of the country, and our story ran all over the Telegraph, and it was picked up everywhere, and that was the beginning. And I realized then, my God, this is a fantastic job. This is just an incredible gig.
So when you went there to the north, that's what you wanted to do, was to take the pictures of the mines?
Yes. I mean, I didn't. He knew more about it because he was based in Tirana. He'd been there for about 6 weeks, and he had a little bit of a knowledge. We also, through him, got a translator who was, Albanian professor who was trying to earn, a couple of dollars a day working for us two layabouts. So, it was a fantastic deal, and it was an extraordinary experience. I mean, it was like stepping back, to be honest with you, like stepping back to the pre-industrial revolution days, and climbing thousands and thousands of feet on rotten wooden ladders down into these sulfur and chromium mines. It was extraordinary and so poisonous and so dangerous, but it was our break, and he went on to be the bureau chief in Bosnia for AFP, Agence France-Presse, and I went on to, I want to say bigger and better things, it's debatable, But that whetted my appetite for photography. And being published is, as I'm sure I know Brooks will testify to as well, is a great feeling as a photographer, especially mm-hmm. if it's something worth, which mm-hmm. you put a lot of effort and mm-hmm. blood and sweat and tears into. Went on to, this was my break, went on to cover all the wars in Eastern Europe, and I spent a lot of time in Central and Eastern Africa during the 90s, including Rwanda, 8 different trips to Rwanda, and a lot of time in Somalia and Burundi and the Southern Sudan, the war in Southern Sudan, and came to America in 97. Burnt out, really. Mm-hmm. I was a bit of a head case. And I'd seen too much and been terrified too much and really was realizing that it wasn't for me. There's people out there, and again, Brooks will agree with me, who are very, very good at it. And he's been in some nasty situations himself. And I'd rather leave the people who are good at that to do that, because I'm more of a hindrance, in a way, to them, because, you know, it's not what I want to do. And came to America in 97, and I'll wrap this up. I moved to Texas because of a girl. of course. hand in hand with the school darkroom. Started working for a Texas magazine, which is a great magazine called Texas Monthly. And this fantastic art director down there in Austin called DJ Stout, who's fabulous. He's no longer there. He's now a big ad man at a company called Pentagram. But he sent me on all kinds of wonderful stories in Texas. And Texas is just like the ultimate mm-hmm. Canvas for a photographer. I mean, it's just extraordinary. The people are extraordinary. The countryside is incredible to photograph. And one of the stories that he sent me on was this story about a group of young idealists, I want to say, fresh out of college, who were working for the Child Protection Services in Texas, something called Unit 25. And now Unit 25 was horribly underfunded, but their job was to literally run into crack houses around Texas and other equally horrible places and grab, you know, babies mm-hmm. out of these places. They didn't even have cell phones. They were so underfunded. It was the most extraordinary. They were so tired, so burnt out, and this incredible group of young kids mm-hmm. who there was this huge turnover rate with, but there was this core of them who was just doing this. And anyway, I spent 3 weeks following these kids around in these extraordinary experiences. And it was heavy. It was a grim story, to say the least. And the magazine published the piece, and it was like an 8-page photo essay. And fantastically, the piece raised a huge amount of awareness to these kids in Texas mm-hmm. and raised something like $6 million for this mm-hmm. unit through donations coming in from, you know, the people with big hair in Texas. And lo and behold, I didn't know this at the time, but of course found out afterwards, Laura Bush, the now First Lady, it was the patron of you know, was heavily involved in mm-hmm. in this Unit 25, and kind of requested to meet me, and we kind of I was actually working on something else when I met her, and she remembered that I'd done this and stuff like mm-hmm. this, and it was kind of an in into mm-hmm. the world of the Bushes, and I mm-hmm. utilized it. I haven't utilized much in my life, but I utilized this. And cut a long story short, because Brooks knows how long this story is, but I basically pitched the Bush campaign, or the Bushes initially, not even, this was way before the campaign, I pitched them that they let me document the next 2 years of their life, that I wanted to really just mm-hmm. see into their world. And, you know, of course, I'm English, and so, you know, I'm foreign. And consequently, you know, the idea of an election is still fascinating to me. Mm-hmm. I had no political interests in any way. I was just the whole circus mm-hmm. of the American political system. It's mm-hmm. you know, extraordinary. And I spent the next 2 years basically working on this project, shooting all in black and white with these little German Leica cameras. And, I won't even start. And he was by my side as well. And the two of us had all kinds of trials and, you know, tribulations, I mean, to say the least. But again, what happened was I kind of fell into this political scene. And when this campaign, much to my surprise, and if he's listening, he knows what I mean, he won. Suddenly, you know, I had Newsweek magazine, who I'd worked with extensively in Europe, but covering wars and stuff, and in Africa, asking me, because I was well connected now in the White House, with this administration, would I be prepared to leave my lovely home in Austin, which I married a this Texan, and would I move to Washington? And that was four years ago now, and I've been living in Washington ever since, primarily covering the White House for Newsweek magazine as their kind of main man on the White House.
When you went to the Bushes, were you freelancing at that
Absolutely,
point?
Yeah. I mean, I was a free merchant. In those days, I was freelancing for the Sunday Times magazine, and that's the London Sunday Times magazine, and anyone who would really give me work. I was prepared to work for Teen People. And we all were. I mean, you know, freelancing is a tough business.
It's a very tough business.
Let's not kid ourselves. And, you know, we're very, very, very and lucky, Brooks and I, to be contract photographers. We were very lucky.
And so was the pitch that that you would distribute these pictures around a lot of different news organizations, you would hold them for the next
Initially, it was very, very complicated because it was actually a bit of a saga, to put it lightly. Initially, what I said to them was, if you give me the access, I'll carry a film camera on, you know, I'll carry a separate camera, and you can have access to these pictures out of this camera, and you can do whatever you want with them. They're yours to document. Everything else is mine. It's my stuff. You can have the film out of this camera. I don't care what you do. And what I'd do is, to get the real access, is I would kind of go in and take a horrible picture of bless their hearts, but of Bush meeting with Mrs. Texas and shaking their hands, and I'd give them the film. But it would get me into these rooms, and I worked that for a long time with my black and white film, which was, you know, often. It was, and Brooks will, you know, vouch for this. It was often not particularly positive pictures. I mean, you know, sometimes this film was like, you know, it was not necessarily stuff that they would want to be seen. The rest of it, I was my film to do what I wanted with. Of course, this became increasingly a problem because I was had a deal with Newsweek magazine, who had sole rights to my pictures. And of course, the crossover was kind of like, by 1999, some period in 1999, the crossover was, you know, film camera shooting for them, my cameras. What capacity was I in that room under? And of course, you know, it became a real problem. It became a real problem in other people's minds ethically. In my mind, because I had too many damn cameras, and in the Bush's mind, you know, this guy is a Newsweek photographer, but he's shooting pictures for us, and why are we letting him in here to take pictures of the candidate in his underwear? You know, so the whole thing was kind of very complicated, and eventually ended up going horribly wrong. But you know, that's the nature of the beast.
And where did you come in on this? What kind of arrangement did you have on the campaign?
Well, I got assigned to cover Bush's first campaign trip, which was in June of '99, and that's when I met Charles, because he was already entrenched in this relationship, and I basically became Time Magazine's photographer on the campaign. So we spent the next year and a half. Covering the campaign, and I was there probably 80 to 90% of the time. You probably something similar. And you know, there were many times when it was just Charles and myself, and there might be a local photographer, but we would travel on a plane with Bush, and you know, five or six members of his senior staff, you know, during the quiet periods in the campaign. Mm-hmm. Of course, around the conventions, and on that first trip, there was 150 members of the press, so it was very different. But you know, we they would all leave, and then it would it would just be a very small group of journalists.
How many reporters were there that were covering?
At what stage?
Well, let's say in 99.
Well, you know,
remember Ken Herman was talking about how few.
As I said, in the beginning, like on that first trip, and in the beginning, there was a huge amount of interest. You know, because there was all this buzz about Bush, right from the start. But then it kind of tailed off. Mm-hmm. You know, and I
what's happening with Kerry now?
Yeah, exactly. You know, the political cycle has these big events, conventions. Among them, and of course, it's always in the when you go from Labor Day to Election Day, there's you know 100 plus members of the press following the candidates through. Mm-hmm. But right now in the Kerry campaign, you know there's you've been out there. What is there? Probably 10 people.
Very few now.
Yeah, if that. Yeah.
During the primary, all the primaries up in New Hampshire and Iowa.
Yeah.
You couldn't move for press.
Right.
I mean, it was everything the candidate would want. I mean, he had. You know, saturation coverage of everything he said.
Yeah.
And in Kerry's case, it worked. He came out of the gloom and doom of being in the shadows, obviously, only 3 weeks before he won Iowa. Mm-hmm. Now, it's a different ballgame. And it will be, you know, Kerry's people would love to have, you know, us lot around. Right now, and periodically we go in, do a little bit, and come out again.
Mm-hmm.
But it's going to be kind of a tough time between now and the end of July, which is obviously the Democratic conventions. And it's kind of like they're trying very hard, as you know, Martha, to try and keep a message out there, which is obviously made increasingly difficult by what's going on in Iraq. You know.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, in the last campaign cycle, we stuck straight through. I mean, we were there pretty much. I would take a week off here or there, but we were there pretty much straight through it. So during this time, when there's only a few people around, and that's when you get to know the candidate, you develop relationships with the communications people, and also when you see things, you know, that most people don't see. You know, and because it's a smaller operation, it's a whole different ballgame.
Mm-hmm. And of course, you get to know the candidate. In such a close way that once he comes into the White House, you have a good sense of who he is, and then also how he changes.
And with
over
these
time.
Guys, you know, I can't speak for prior presidents because I just simply didn't cover them. But with these guys, it's all about relationships with these people.
Mm-hmm.
I was very surprised. You know, Brooks and I, you know. Gain a little bit of access now and then because of those days of spending, you know, sitting with Karen Hughes and Karl Rove in a small plane.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. And our magazine's kind of invested, I suppose, in that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's how it's happened.
Uh-huh. Let's look at some of your photographs. You each have pictures of sort of the public and the private.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to just firstly say that, you know, that this 40 picture set is just an example for you guys of oh, someone's leaving.
She's going to get a smoke.
You're going to miss out. This 40 picture set is not definitive by any means. It's a 1.5 day bus trip that I went on last week. Which kind of signals in a way, I mean, there's been fundraising galore in the Bush world, which is obviously very it's campaign related, but really this bus trip that we did last week is the first time in this election cycle, I think, that, you know, here we go again.
Uh-huh.
You know, Bush, Cheney, 04 everywhere, screaming people, you know, bus, you know, waving out the bus, blah, blah, blah. And so this was, you know, as a magazine, of course, we didn't run any of it, but that's another story altogether because Rumsfeld became such a big story.
Yeah, right.
But we went out and we spent a day and a half with Bush, And what I'm going to show you is just the take that I sent the magazine. Mm-hmm. This is what I transmitted to the magazine on Tuesday, basically giving them an option to use one of these pictures if the story would hold. Very unusual, I might add, for a story to hold Tuesday through the end of the right. week. Yeah. So I was kind of slightly aware that, you know, this was really for long term. You know, this was probably something that we might come back to at the end of the year.
And that's what in magazines, you know, we have. We're not as fixed. When you pick up a newspaper, in general, you see pictures, you know, contextual pictures from events that happened yesterday. But magazines, you know, even if we knew that it was unlikely, let's say the Rumsfeld story had already developed and this bus trip came up and we knew it was unlikely the pictures were going to be used next week, we would still go out because it's part of developing a library of mm-hmm. photos. You basically just have to go out there and cover everything because you don't know exactly what you're going to need and when you're going to need it. And our magazines make last-minute decisions, and suddenly they're looking for a picture of Bush as a campaigner, or they're looking for a picture of Bush with his wife, or they're looking for a picture of Bush with one of his advisors. And the only way you get it is to cover everything.
How do you archive the pictures? Do you you have them on your own laptops, but mm-hmm. when they go into the magazine, How does the magazine keep them?
Very secret formula.
They have a better way than us.
They're just we just have massive image servers in New York, and they have software to browse the photos, and they can the editors can sit at their desk and type in, you know, Bush campaign 2004, and then push a button, and then all the pictures come up. You know, it's, there's huge search engines. I keep everything as well on my end, archiving on DVDs and external hard drives. And one of the nice things about digital is when we covered the first campaign, it was all film, and it was always, I mean, it's unbelievable. You know, the stuff just gets, because we each have, you know, 10 editors, and they're each working on two different stories, you know, and everyone's chasing down that little slide or negative or print, and stuff just gets lost and misplaced, and it's hard to find. And now, actually, with digital, it's a lot easier because, and in some ways, potentially more dangerous too. But we can talk about that at another time. But because the pictures can be, I can have an original, my editors can have an original. You know, I can have an original here in New York, and it all can move around very quickly instead of just, you know, it all being tied to the physical presence of a slide or a negative.
Uh-huh. And do you, when you're archiving them, do you put down, like, for a particular picture, this is, you know, President and Mrs. Bush, and several things about it, so you can then pull it up just by going through and doing a search, a word search?
Yeah, that's very important, is writing, this has been an experience, I know for me, is writing good captions, because that's the way pictures are searched. So, mm-hmm. you know, in the picture, like the one up on the screen there, you know, it's got to say Laura Bush in there, or anything else that's pertinent to it. So when an editor's searching, you know, the right pictures come up.
Yeah. Okay. Charles, do you want to?
One picture, and I dropped the whole system. Another thing. You know, talking about this digital stuff is, okay, you know, let's not forget that we. You know, I lost a horrible amount of film during that 2 years campaign because, you know, too many cooks in the kitchen.
Absolutely.
Too many people handling.
Where would
stuff.
They get lost?
Who knows? I mean, you know, I could have, you know, the kick-ass image sitting on the coffee room floor in New York, for all I know, under the fridge.
Uh-huh.
So are we going through this? Can I talk a little bit about
that? Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we're going to go through this pretty quickly. But
let's go back to the first one. Can we go back to it?
Yeah.
And where was it?
You know, we basically, you know, Brooks and I, we're also, as much as we work for the magazine, we're also represented by two very good agencies. Myself, Contact Press in New York and Paris, and Brooks's case, Corbis, which is pretty much everywhere. Mm-hmm. And so when we see people like the First Lady, and this might sound a little bit naff, it's actually important for stock to photograph, if you can, reasonably nice pictures of these two together, because you don't get to see them together that much. And it's very good stock for the agency, because that is your kind of, I don't know if this is, but it's kind of your future, it's your pension in a way as a mm-hmm. photographer, you know, mm-hmm. all this. So, for instance, you know, this is a bit of a happy, smiley picture, but it's good stock. And it's something yeah. that, you know, people can mm-hmm. come to in Paris if they're doing something about the First Lady's fashion. And so we mm-hmm. shoot these quite generic images sometimes, which, mm-hmm. you know, we don't look at as art. Let's not kid ourselves. But they're good. They're a good thing to do. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. And for an editorial photographer, because, you know, we don't make that much money from our magazines, having the secondary source of income for your pictures is very important. Uh-huh. And these our pictures are published subsequently, you know, in magazines around the world, if we do a good job.
Right.
How do you determine which ones go to your magazines and which ones go elsewhere?
I send the whole take to the magazine, and I'll yeah. send the same take to my agency. Right. If you go on, let's move along. This is an image that, of course, I like, but will never see the light of day. And this is very typical of mm-hmm. us and our business. We shoot pictures like this because we kind of like kind right, of the imagery
yeah.
in it.
Yeah.
But it's never going to be used, but certainly not by maybe uh-huh. our magazines.
Right.
Let's keep going. Standard.
Where are these taken?
These are all in Ohio and Michigan,
uh-huh.
and these first ones are in Michigan, mm-hmm. in Detroit, and you know, for all, you know, Bush is a good man, and Brooks would agree with me. He's a good man. You know, we try and make the most out of these situations. These situations are diabolical for photography. This guy is standing at a podium, surrounded by a bunch of screaming Republicans, and they're invariably not that well lit. Or reasonably lit, better than Kerry's people, and you know, it's hard to make pictures at these things. You know, sometimes it's fabulous to see mm-hmm. some of the kind of artists of the world come uh-huh. and try and do this, because they come in and they're like, I don't know how you do this. This is a nightmare. Mm-hmm. And it's really difficult to make pictures of someone standing with a microphone. Take my word for it. Mm-hmm. You know, but Bush, anyway, as I was going to say, Bush is quite. As far as this goes, he's quite good to photograph because he's very expressive, and his mm-hmm. face is just, you know, he has so many different expressions, doesn't mm-hmm. he? Mm-hmm. He, you know, he's like this, or, you know, he's uh-huh. he's all over the place yeah. with his face,
and you can watch him
in his body too. I mean, you know, let's keep going. Yes, standard fare, walking around. These pictures usually come from being bored and having heard the speech a thousand times. And so you go wandering off into the audience, and again, this is kind of stock.
Uh-huh.
Just in case a big story came out that week,
uh-huh.
standard procedure is to take a headshot. Just in case, you know, big story comes out about Bush, so you'll always just take a few headshots. Uh-huh. Brooks is the king of it. Let's keep going. More of the same. This is just three examples of his body language.
Yeah, that's
flick on through.
Yeah.
These images are slightly off because they're compressed to fit on the screen. Yeah. But these kind of, what this body language and the way he expresses himself happen in over a period of seconds. He's like this, like this.
That's nice.
And those are images of when he's happy. You know, when he's content, when he's comfortable. He yeah. does those kinds of things. When he's uncomfortable,
yeah.
he has other kinds
but
of...
But Bush is surprisingly good on the podium like this, when he's got 5,000 people around mm-hmm. him shouting and screaming. He never used to be, as we'll both tell you about.
No,
but it's when you put him in front of a TV camera that he seems to kind of like just... You know how we see these...
Like a wrestler?
When he talks to the nation... When he speaks to the nation,
he's in front of TV cameras here. But what you're saying is, when he's got a big speech together,
when he's got a big speech, he's kind of quite expressive.
Mm.
When you see him in front of, when he speaks to the nation at 8 o'clock on during The Sopranos,
mm-hmm.
he sits there and he bless his heart, you know, he's had someone do a lot of makeup. I'm going to get shot when I walk outside. But we, you know, someone do a lot of makeup, and you know, he's very kind of like deer in the headlights.
That's when he's sitting.
And he's not, that's not at his best. That's not what's best for him. You know, it's extraordinary. Anyway, so this, again, this is just another angle. The whole key to our game, and when Brooks comes on here, testify to it too, magazine photographers, their job is to try and get something different to what is on the wires from each event. So we'll never really publish a picture that is very similar to a picture that has been that past week in all the newspapers. And so we're kind of a nuisance because we're always moving around, but we're trying to always photograph things in the most mundane situations, but in a different way.
Uh-huh. And that's a good example.
That's a good example.
Yeah. That's very difficult to do, though, isn't it?
Oh, it's very hard.
Very difficult. Yeah. I mean, it is. And it's so funny because the other photographers, the newspaper photographers and the wire photographers all think we're slightly batty. But we are actually trying to do something.
But sometimes it's as simple as just an expression or a moment. You know, it doesn't have to be a dramatic angle, although it can be.
Yeah. I remember one day in the Oval Office, you were shooting the picture of not just the president, but you were shooting a picture that had Andy Card and had Condi Rice, Colin Powell, and Rumsfeld, I think, in it.
Right.
And so that you were interested in not just what the president was doing, you were trying to shoot that shot. And I remember also one day when both of you were shooting different pictures within the Oval Office, and I think there was people were unhappy that you were trying to take pictures of the desk and all sorts of things.
Barney. Yeah. Standard campaign fare, but you know, again, you know, it's the kind of, you know, beginning of the season. You can't really see this picture, but Blake, his kind of aide, is kind of funny the way he's opening the door for him, but you can't really tell in the picture on the TV screen. Let's keep going.
Is he just trying not to be in the picture?
He's just trying to not be in the picture. Of course, that to us guys means he has to be in the
picture.
Just, you know, Bush's eyes, flags, again, standard fare. Let's keep going.
We look for this a lot. Like, that's really nice, unusual light.
Mm-hmm. And those are actually people standing up there, you know, on the hilltop.
Yeah. Where was it?
Somewhere
in the Heartland. It was
Detroit. Detroit.
Yeah, because that was one.
Yeah. Okay, let's keep going. That's just a wider version of the same picture.
Yeah.
Let's keep going. This is all in Detroit. Bush coming out. He's about to trip up, but he didn't. Bunch of very excited ladies in red. And then this is always I find this extraordinary. You know, when I was growing up and I was 17 years old, the last thing on my mine was going to a political rally.
That's because you were trying to find a place to smoke.
I was also doing other things. But this blows my mind that, you know, these people are at the front of the stage, and they must have been there for hours. You know, they've been magged, checked, double-checked, three times checked. And these young girls and boys, you know, are screaming and shouting. I mean, that to me is just extraordinary.
Do you find that in the other campaigns? Do you find that when the Kerry campaign, for example?
Yeah, in some ways more so. Yeah, let's keep going. Then you got this lot. Mm-hmm. This is a much more of a typical Republican bunch. Mm-hmm. They're even in the trees. And this, it continues to blow my mind. You know how, you know, this guy was standing in the audience and you know, saying amen, and stuff after Bush's, you know, after Bush was speaking. I was just standing there going, my God. And he's clutching the faith of, I think it's his cover, the faith of pancake breakfast. I mean, what can I say? Okay. Just, you know, have to, you know, we live in hope that we're going to get a double truck in the magazine. A double truck is a double page, and you shoot these kind of pictures because you have this kind of fantasy that you can lay text in the left-hand side of the image, and there's good amount of space for the page break. So we often shoot this way, thinking, you know, design-wise.
Very true.
Does it work?
Not always. Air Force One.
Did you have trouble getting that particular angle? Because they usually try to herd you in a particular area.
Yeah, the key to shooting from back there is to be the last person out of the van. And then what you do is, when you're everyone else is kind of getting onto the plane, you're kind of running across the tarmac, pretending to get on the plane. And what you can do is, but what happens is, because, I mean, you know what I mean. He's then kind of coming up the steps, and you can kind of quickly grab your camera and shoot three or four frames before, you know, anyone sees. And then you pretend to be getting on, then you get on the plane. But, you know, it's you're not meant to really photograph from back there. But, I mean, I have to say, I'm scraping the barrel a bit with these images because, you know, we go on these trips, and often there's not an awful lot to photograph. And so, you know, we're like, we take these pictures because that's what we can get out of it. You know, some days you'll go and we'll come away and we'll go, that was awesome. That was really good for pictures. Some days we'll come back and we'll go, nothing. So this was a bit of a scrape the barrel job, but let's keep on going. Bush coming out. I don't know if you guys can see in Baltimore, but you can see his speech in this picture. I mean, a whole lot of the stuff is underlined, and I always,
yeah,
I was
going to say, is that quite writing?
It's writing, and you know, it's reminding him of the names that he's, you know, people he's talking about. Okay, let's keep going. Again, you know, looking for the double page. Again, looking for the double page.
Text left.
Yeah.
Text left.
Okay, here we go. Bush Cheney 04.
Who drives the bus?
The Secret Service agent. Let's keep going.
Can people see much on the outside? Can they see him?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. But not only out the front window. The rest of it is probably, you know, 4-inch steel. Notice that the Secret Service agent actually is a cardboard cutout.
Were you able to get into the bus?
No. Of course I wanted to.
You didn't figure a way? But no. It's early in the campaign.
No, I'll get on. I'll get onto the wretched thing one day. Did you get on the bus?
No.
Secret Service agent again. We often use them to frame our pictures. They can become quite useful.
They're everywhere also.
No, they're everywhere. Let's keep on going. I mean, you know, 6 months before the election and these auditoriums are filled.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, again, I can't reiterate it enough. I'm completely apolitical. I'm neither a Republican or Democrat. I make fun of both of them.
A contrarian.
But I really do. I mean, you know, this kind of thing is pretty. There's a lot of people out there supporting this guy. I mean, you know, again, I'll get shot when I walk out the door. But I haven't been seeing these kind of crowds with his opposition.
And in 2000, did you see the same kinds of crowds, or what were the crowds like?
Yeah, bigger and bigger. They get bigger and bigger. Again, you know, trying to make something out of the podium. You know, there's a big podium there, and you know, you'll find us two and a couple of the other photographers lying down in the buffer zone, as it's called, trying to make. I mean, contorting ourselves, trying to get the podium out of the picture. And you know, this is you know, invariably how this is.
Do you use remote cameras on the campaign trail?
I don't. I don't. You probably don't on the campaign trail, do you?
Sometimes I do. Sometimes we set up. I think I may have some examples of it to show. But we set up cameras on like little mini tripods or clamp them onto things and then fire them remotely, simply because we want to get an angle from somewhere and we can't be there. We can't stand there, so we do use remote cameras.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's finish up. I think that's just another variation. And that's my lot. That's from about a 24-hour period in on the road last week.
Okay.
And that's the take I sent to the magazine, in case they wanted to do something on that. I mean, the obvious picture would be from that set would probably be the waving from the bus picture.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, that's kind of that's a very typical set of pictures that would be sent to the magazine from a day on the road. And we do a lot of this. I mean, you know, we go on the road a lot.
Uh-huh.
The key to it is to be pool, which means you get to fly on Air Force One and you get home 4 hours early.
Okay. Brooks, can you show us your pictures? Can you tell us about the opportunity that you had? And including how did you get the opportunity?
Well, first, why don't I show some of the pictures first, so people know what we're talking about, and then we can talk about it. Are you ready?
Yes.
All right. Do I need to start it or? Occasionally, probably once or twice a year, Charles and I both get an opportunity to shoot something that's not public, that's not open to the press corps, it's been coined sort of behind the scenes. It's exclusive access, and these kinds of opportunities can come up in a variety of different ways. But for me, I basically try to come up with an idea, and first talk to my editors about it, and then pitch it to if they sign off on it, then pitch it to the White House. And this first one is from is sort of the day of his State of the Union speech, not this last one in 2004, but 2003. So it's spending just a day with him at the White House and then traveling with him to give his State of the Union speech, which was a big deal at the time, and I can't even remember why now.
In retrospect, that's the one that had the 16 words.
Yes. Yeah, that was it. Okay, so this is the morning before the State of the Union speech, talking in the cabinet room with Christy Todd Whitman.
And you were there by yourself as far as the photography?
Yeah, well, these aren't coming up in order, but we'll, in any case, this is, it's a little hard to see here, too, on the TV screen. I'm by myself, except there are White House photographers that are pretty much always around, but there's no other press around. So it's standard to have the White House photographers document just about everything that the president does. He's working on the final draft of his speech with an assistant in the Oval Office.
Mm-hmm. Who was the assistant? Was it
Harriet
Myers?
She was the person in charge of paper. Harriet.
Harriet Myers.
Oh yeah,
staff secretary.
Yeah, staff secretary.
She's now a deputy chief of staff
for
policy.
This is Rumsfeld and Powell, and sometimes little things will come out of these stories. Like this is a picture we ended up using extensively through the war. This because Rumsfeld and Powell, of course, were on opposite ends of the political spectrum, and they're talking just before a cabinet meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, fortunately, these are out of order. Filing, but this is just before he goes up and gives a State of the Union speech, talking with Daschle and other House leadership in a room right off the floor.
How long would he be in that room?
Like 5 minutes. And then this is from the floor while he's giving the speech, receiving a standing ovation from the Republicans on the right, while the Democrats on the left sit.
Yes, nice.
Now we're going back This is a picture that was taken during a cabinet meeting where he basically filled his cabinet meeting in on what he was going to say in the State of the Union speech. And the Bush cabinet starts every meeting with a prayer. And this is a picture that we used a lot that got played extensively.
Great.
Because it had mm-hmm. you know, it's got Powell, Rumsfeld, everybody in it. And it sort of captured a little bit of the tension. Attention of the time. Next. This is right before he goes out to give the speech. He clears everybody out of the room and spends a couple minutes collecting his thoughts. So I'm in there just for a second to take, literally 15 seconds, get a picture, and then leave him alone.
And there's nobody else in there?
No, there's a White House photographer in there and maybe one other photographer from the Senate or something, but there's no, this isn't a picture that was published anywhere until it ran in time.
Would the other photographers, do you all just have a tacit understanding, you just stay out of each other's way so that when they can see when you're lining up for a picture, they will make sure to be out of the way?
In this situation, no, it's, I don't know if there's a tacit understanding, but, it's sometimes, you ask if there is another photographer in the room. And again, in this case, it's just one, mm-hmm. as I remember. So it's not that hard. But, we talk, but there are no ground rules per se.
Mm-hmm.
This is as he comes out on the floor. And this is after the speech with his sister and Laura Bush and a niece or something. I can't remember who. I think that's it for that one. All right, let me show you one other group.
Control A.
Okay, so
Brooks, Control A. You have to select on the.
Okay, this is a series of pictures that was taken out on the ranch. Bush spends a tremendous amount of time on his Texas ranch. He's been there like two or three hundred days. He spent 200 or 300 at this. These pictures were taken on December 29th, 2003. And at that point, there's a guy, Mark Noller, who works for CBS Radio, and he keeps stats of everything. And he told me that he had spent 257 days as president on the ranch. And so, which to me is extraordinary, and yet we see very little of what he does out there. So the idea was to just go spend some time with him and see a little bit of what he does, what his typical day's like. And it took me about 6 or 7 months to set this up. I tried over and over again, and for one reason or another, he wanted a vacation, he didn't want anybody around, it wasn't the right time, and so it's a process of continually requesting and talking to the press secretary about it. And finally, I got an opportunity to do it in December. So this is driving to, every morning he has an intelligence briefing, even when he's on the ranch. And this is driving with his dog to the briefing at about 7:30 in the morning. And this is inside a trailer, a secure trailer on the ranch where he has a hookup. I don't know if you can tell here. You could see it in the magazine. But that's Dick Cheney on the screen on the left there, Condi Rice, and somebody from the CIA. And he gets his morning intelligence briefing, and this is, at least the day that I was there, this was sort of the work portion of the day. He spends an hour or two in the trailer. And on a picture like that, I'm in the room for 30 seconds. I'm not sitting there listening to the whole briefing. Uh-huh. These are glimpses. Then his favorite pastime is to cut cedar brush on his ranch, and he goes out with a chainsaw and clears land. He explained that, I guess, in Texas, the undergrowth prevents the all this shrubbery sucks up all the water, and if you don't cut it away, you don't get big, large trees on the ranch. So there's an environmental element to it. But for him, I think it's just a way to release a lot of energy. Mm-hmm. He's with a group of people shouting, you know, hey, let's clear this over here. Let's burn this. Let's. He really, really enjoys it.
Who are the people that are there that are helping?
Staff people, deputy chief of staff.
anybody who couldn't figure out how to get out of it?
right. A few ranch hands. So it's sort of a mixture of people that locals, people that work for him. Mm-hmm. And then he burns. He makes these big piles of the brush that they cut and burns it. Mm-hmm. He spent about two hours doing this, mm-hmm. which he does just about every day he's out there. That's the guy he bought the ranch land from.
How many acres is it?
I want to say it's 1,600 acres.
Yeah, you're right.
Yep.
It's about 1,600.
That's the house. I wanted to show something where you could see a little bit of the house. It's actually quite small.
Yeah, it looks like. How many square feet do you think?
I don't know, maybe 2,000. So, or 2,000, mm-hmm. 3,000. I mean, it's not 10,000 plus.
So it doesn't dominate the landscape.
No, not
way.
At all. No. In fact, you know, if you're any distance from it, it's very hard to see.
Yeah.
He fishes every day with his dog.
And what kind of fish are in there?
Widemouth bass, stocked, of course.
Yeah, that's what I was going
to ask. This picture was actually taken in the morning when he was walking to his truck.
Yeah.
And so that's it. That's just, and again, it's, you know, I look at this as a glimpse, you know, as a way to sort of take a peek inside something. I mean, he knows I'm there. It's not meant to be a sort of a definitive story, but the idea is to see a little bit of something, to show a little bit of something to our readers that doesn't normally get seen. Mm-hmm. But these things are really, really hard to set up and to organize, and there's a tremendous amount of competition to get them, as you can imagine. And we're not just talking about Time and Newsweek; we're talking about newspapers, networks. The hundreds of different organizations that cover the White House.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they seem to like television mm-hmm. and a great deal.
Right.
And what was the winning argument that you presented on this, of why they should do it?
The winning argument that I presented, and it's actually one of the main reasons I wanted to do it, was this is a place Bush loves more than anywhere. Mm-hmm. This is the place he loves to be. And he's spending a lot of time there, and nobody really, nobody's seen very much of it. I mean, he has a press conference out there, you know, with the prime minister, or a president, or a foreign leader, but that's two podiums,
right.
And you know, you don't see anything more than a hay bale in the background.
Mm-hmm.
I think they understood what I was trying to do, and it was a question of then. Figuring out a good time to do it.
Did you hear from them afterwards?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they liked it.
Mm-hmm. How do you hear?
It's interesting because, you know, the picture from the sequence that provided the most, that I heard the most about was him holding the chainsaw.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing about it was that people that really did not like Bush thought it was a terrific photo because he looked like a lunatic with a chainsaw. And people that did like Bush, you know, from the White House thought it was really cool because he looked macho and, you know, he was, and in my mind, you know, that's actually the mark of a good picture, is if, because we live in such a polarized world now with Bush. I mean, it's unbelievable. You know, people, we ran a cover about a year ago, Love Him or Hate Him, and how America is polarized. And it's really true. I mean, I don't know. I hear it and see it everywhere we go, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can take a picture that that sort of both sides of this chasm that we live in respond mm-hmm. to, then mm-hmm. that's...
Have you found, both of you, since you started taking pictures of Bush, that his sense of the camera has changed? That that he has become more comfortable with the camera, more interested in what comes out of the camera?
I had, and I think Charles too, had a lot of trouble with him early on because he didn't really understand photojournalism. He thought when you took a picture, you know, taking a picture meant looking at the camera and smiling. So, you know, we would be in these situations and he would see us, you know, stop and smile at the camera, which of mm-hmm. course is not uh-huh. what we want. And I think slowly he's begun to understand that, although a lot of times that's still a challenge, especially if you're the only person in the room, mm-hmm. you know, if you're the only person there.
That's tough. Mm-hmm. I mean, I want to say that he's gotten a little better, but I'm not sure he has. I mean, you know, the thing, it's not, you know, I don't mean that in a nasty way in yeah. any way. I think he's easily distracted, and I think that we're a distraction to him.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, my dream is, and I'm into a certain degree, I'm sure Brooks is the same, is to go into this guy's, into a meeting in the Oval Office or wherever, and, you know, just be forgotten about and just let to, mm-hmm. you know, to be a fly on the wall. Mm-hmm. Not to have someone turn to you and go, what do you want me to do?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's like, that's the worst case scenario.
Right.
And, mm-hmm. you know, when someone says that and you say, just do what you're doing, sir. That means that you immediately yeah. got to register that you're there, and that means that the photo is going to be crap.
Uh-huh.
You
it's
know,
very true.
I sometimes look at Clinton. I mean, you know, I don't know what Clinton is like because, of course, I didn't cover him. But I look at some of the photographers like Diana Walker and people mm-hmm. who were photographing mm-hmm. Clinton,
uh-huh.
and they look like genuine moments. I mean, they look mm-hmm. like this guy would go about his business, just yeah. like a colleague, a good friend of mine, a guy called Nick Danzinger, who's been doing a story on Blair in England. Blair mm-hmm. is completely, you know, will go about his business as if he's not there, and Nick will just photograph this guy, and consequently gets amazing photographs of real yeah. real moments, and I find that quite tough for the White
House. It's very hard with Bush. And he has to really be involved. I think I can count on one hand the number of times I've photographed him where I really felt like he sort of forgot that right. I was in the room. And I think on election night, Charles and I were with him on election night in 2000, while you know, there was all these twists and turns in the mm-hmm. in what was coming in. And I felt like that night, you know, he really forgot we were there. And then a couple of times post 9/11 in meetings and things, you know, there's been glimpses of it, but in general he's very aware, and as a result it is very difficult to mm-hmm. capture candidates.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's take some questions. Towson?
Having known the Bushes so long, why are there personal feelings toward both of you, and both of your feelings, personal feelings toward the Bushes?
Personal?
Yeah.
Personally, when Bush is not in front of a TV camera, he is very, very engaging, very funny, and just an enjoyable person to be around. He has a very different personality, it's actually striking to me sometimes. During the campaign, we were walking in and out of that world a lot more than I am now. It's really hard to understand how different he is when there's not a lot of press around. And I got the sense in talking to Diana Walker, who did this kind of thing with Clinton, the Clinton, you know, the Clinton, I think Clinton was more of sort of one personality. You know, he didn't have this public persona, this private persona.
I totally agree with you. And you know, he was extremely kind. He's been extremely kind to me at times. Mm-hmm. On a personal level, again, I think he's actually a nice chap. And Brooks and I sat and analyzed the hell out of this because of talking about our photography and trying to work out, when's the best time to try and photograph this guy. We've spent years looking at his every move. Can you imagine doing that? you become very good at judging, at very perceptive of being able to tell what kind of mood someone's in. So we're quite kind of clued into this this guy. But on a personal level, him and the First Lady, I mean, she's a lovely, lovely woman.
Yeah,
and as a kind, sweet-natured woman who is the furthest you could think from being a political figure. I mean, she's very nice. And as I say, Bush has at times been extremely sweet and to me, and quite a different personality to the person that you and I see, on a public level.
I think one thing that that I picked up on immediately was he does not enjoy formality in these big sort of formal, elaborate White House type things. I can remember when we went to Normandy. He's going again next month, but we went to Normandy. I had this image in my mind as a child of this great photograph of Reagan walking through the graveyard in Normandy with all the crosses. It was one of those images that that I remember seeing and that's always kind of been embedded in my mind. And when I heard that Bush was going to go do this thing, I was like, oh, this is great. You know, I finally have a chance to make this kind of picture and this historic site. And we got there and Bush practically ran through the graveyard. I mean, it was unbelievable. And, he just didn't, and it was this big thing, the lights, the cameras, everything. He doesn't, whereas Clinton, that Clinton and Reagan would respond much differently to that. And part of why I wanted to go to the ranch was because I know he loves it there. And you see an entirely different, a different kind of person.
Mm-hmm. What do you see has taken place as far as his aging, the impact of the office on him? Do you see it in from the campaign in 2000? Do you see that he looks different than he did then?
I think he's aged. Visually, uh-huh. I think he's aged. I think his face has aged, and I think his actual demeanor, his whole demeanor has aged. But on a character level, I don't mm-hmm. get to see enough of him behind the scenes to really be able to say, really. But I don't think, mm-hmm. I think he's still kind of similar. I mean, he's got to have changed, let's face it. I mean, the last 4 years would have changed anyone. Mm-hmm. But
yeah, I would agree with that.
Okay. A question from here? Anybody have a question?
Earlier you mentioned the importance of relationships with this administration. Like, do you feel that you censor a lot of your work so that you can keep relationships with them?
That's a good
relationship?
Question.
Very good.
No, you can't. I mean, you can't censor your work. We've both put pictures out there, that they aren't happy with. And you just can't do it. Where it becomes very difficult, though, is in the exclusive behind the scenes situations. It's one thing from a public event, but when you're the only person in the room, I'm very careful. I'm involved in the editing and the selection of pictures by the magazine, and I'm very careful to not pick pictures that I think are unfair. Now that doesn't mean that, like for example, the picture of him with the chainsaw. A lot of people could look at that picture and say he looks like a madman. To me, I looked at it and said, okay, well that really captures, that's what it looked like when we were out there. And you can look at it either way. But if there was a picture that, if that really wasn't what it looked like out there, you know, I would be very careful about sending photographs in that, you know, that aren't accurate representations. So from a public event, no. I mean, you know, if I have more pictures here, we're not going to have time to look at today. You know, of him crying, of him looking pissed off, of him scowling, and we send those pictures in all. We send those pictures in all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's tough. I totally agree with. Very good question there.
Yeah.
I totally agree with Brooks. Public event, it's kind of open game.
Yeah.
But when you're, you know, behind the scenes, it's a tough one. And, you know, I won't go into it now, but I had a very good example last year. One of the dangerous things with us now shooting digital, funnily enough, is that quite often we'll take a picture and then we'll go and work on the, you know, we'll download the images from our cameras onto our computers and work on the pictures, getting ready to send them to the magazine. Now, what that means is invariably we're in places where other people can see us working on our computers. You can become so involved in working on those pictures that you forget that, in fact, someone could walk behind you and look over your shoulder and see the picture you're working on and go, oh, my God. Well, a case happened like that for me about a year ago where I was behind the scenes and I got an opportunity to photograph the president in a way, you know, that was unique and was different. And I was invited by the president to go and, you know, to go and photograph this particular situation. Now, I couldn't turn around to the president and say, I'm sorry, sir, I can't come and photograph you doing that because I'm not authorized to do that. You know, you're being invited by the President of the United States. And anyway, cut a long story short, and I won't go into it now, but it was very tough because I went back after that and started working on this set of pictures that I'd just shot, and one of the people from the press office walked behind me and saw this picture that I was working on and decided this was not what they wanted to be going out in a major news magazine. And it caused a nightmare where I had to spend the weekend about 2 or 3 days over a Friday through a Thursday through Saturday fighting for this image to be allowed to be used. Really, you know, it was, you know, my magazine obviously wanted to use it. The White House, they were like, this wasn't authorized. You know, you weren't meant to be there. This wasn't meant, you know, this is not part of our controlled message, essentially. And it was a very difficult situation. And, you know, this came from sitting on my computer working on the on the image.
You probably would have heard from them, though, anyway, when it went out, right?
Oh, yes. I mean, I most definitely.
So it's just a question of when you're going to hear from
them. A very good question and a very difficult situation. Yeah. But it really is. I mean, you know, as Brooks says, you know, public domain, it's open, you know, it's open, right. Open yeah. Game. But, you know, we get back into these situations and it's tough. Mm-hmm. And let's not forget, it's not Bush that we're dealing with here.
Yeah.
Bush is like, you know, do your bloody thing,
yeah.
You know, and yeah. Get on with it. You know, it's all the people
It's the communications people.
It's the communications people all around him who really, you know, it's their job to essentially control the image.
They control the image, and they get nervous, especially if it's something exclusive and that hasn't been talked about in their staff meetings. You know, when these events, they're planned to the tiniest detail, and they know exactly what's going to come out of them. So these sorts of things are wild cards for them, and they don't want to stick their neck out, you know, and be the one that let somebody take a picture of.
Yeah, but staff are very risk averse.
Yes, very risk averse.
It doesn't make any difference what administration. And one of the things that, interestingly, they have managed to control over the years are photographs of the president.
Mm-hmm.
And so the kind of access that you get in those circumstances is really represents something that's a real change.
Right, and the whole thing we're trying to do is show something that really hasn't been seen. So that's, you know, to them, that's a...
So when you send in pictures to your own news organization, are you think carefully about which ones you send? because you're not sending everything. You're sending a sample,
I don't think carefully about it. I send the pictures I like.
Right.
It's as simple as that. I mean, you know,
picture
obviously, if there's a story you know that, that the magazine is working on, you'll send them a selection of pictures, maybe which will tie in with what they're working on editorially. But I generally just send them, I send them pictures that I personally like.
And, and we're desperate to capture any kind of emotion or nuance of personality. So if we have a photograph, you know, where he looks angry, or if he looks frustrated, or if he looks euphoric, you know, we're always looking for that. Because those moments are hard to find, you know, in the White House world, which is very controlled and on message.
When you're taking pictures and you're in an exclusive environment and you hear things, are you very careful not to talk about anything that you've heard? Or do you just not hear because you're focusing on what you're doing?
You know what? It's funny. I've been asked that so many times. And you know what? As a photographer, I can speak for myself. Is I'm never listening to what they're talking about. You know, you go into a room, I don't think I've ever come out of one of these rooms and gone, my God, I must tell so-and-so about that. That's extraordinary. I've never, you know.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, there's also a little bit of a, when we're going behind the scenes, like the stuff we do, there's an unwritten rule there that is, you know, is part of the trust. You know, you're not going in there and coming out and telling your reporter, what you just heard.
That's that's very important, and that's simply because we're photographers.
Yeah.
You know, we're not reporters, and that is definitely an unwritten rule, and it's true. I agree. You know that when you're, because when you're thinking visually, you know, when you're looking at light, when you're looking at hand gestures, when you're looking at the combinations of people and trying to figure out how you can compose and make a picture, you know, you can, if somebody shouts or if there's like a loud or something that sort of sticks out, then you might hear it. But if it's just a general hum of conversation,
Having said that, I do remember a time that I went into the Oval Office. I do remember a time I went into the Oval Office to photograph him and Tenet meeting, the Tenet, the head of the CIA. And I remember walking in and Bush turned to me and said, "Oh, we know everything about you." And Tenet looked at me and said, "Everything." and I remember thinking, I remember photographing these two guys standing by a window just out of earshot, but thinking, I wonder what they're talking about.
Towson?
I had a question for Brooks. Earlier you spoke about taking, or you didn't really like the conservative pictures that you had to take for newspapers. And I wanted to see if you could distinguish between a conservative photo and a liberal photo.
If I said conservative, I used the wrong word. What I was trying to, newspapers are, in general, the style of photography in newspapers is much more literal. If I said conservative, I think what I meant to say was literal. You know, it's the president at the event, who was there, who was standing next to him, what's the background. Magazines, we come out weekly, and we're sort of, you know, looking at what's in the president's mind, what is he thinking, what is he feeling, what was the process by which the White House came to decide its policy on Iraq. So the pictures are a little bit more about nuance and personality and a little bit less about the fact that the president went to a military base and he was standing, you know, with Rumsfeld and Powell in front of a tank. So it's a different style of photography. And it's not, it has nothing to do with political ideology, conservative versus liberal.
A question from here? Okay, yeah.
You talk about things being controlled. It seems to me we never see any sign of dissension anywhere near the president. And for those of us who grew up in earlier political eras where the president was always surrounded by signs and things that were in opposition to his politics, is this all really controlled? Is there a free speech zone that...
It's an interesting story about that. just this week on the bus tour, we wanted some photographs of protesters. My editor called me up and said, you know, can you take photographs of protesters? And I said, well, no, you're going to have to send someone else to do that. Because logistically, the way that it works is we come in motorcades and buses, and we're going on the bus tour last week, 3, 4, 5 stops a day. And we come in, and there's all kinds of security issues. You know, we have to be swept and made sure that we're not carrying anything dangerous. And it's not possible for us to sometimes move freely, like out around the events. So there's always a protest area, but sometimes it can be 2 or 3 blocks from the site or across the street from the site, and it can be very difficult. There have been times when we've been able to do it, but it can be very difficult for us to sort of get out of what they call the bubble. And everybody that comes into that bubble has to be swept and made sure that they're secure. So it's difficult.
I think, you know, maybe what you're asking. So you have 5,000 people in an auditorium or in a field. I don't know how they do it, but I think that 5,000 people are either on some kind of Republican mailing list or something, because it's very rare that you have situations where there's a group of people shouting, you know, Bush lied, or, you know, one of the things that people shout. I mean, I think they must vet, you know, these are all young Republicans, young students for Bush, or, you know, they are vetted somehow.
Well, the state party, and it would.
I don't know how they do it. The other thing which is interesting, which is something I found very surprising covering the campaign in 2000, was, you know how they hold up, you see them all the time, these signs that look like they've been painted Ohio for Bush, or so they look like someone, they're like graffiti. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
You know all these signs. Do you know that they aren't graffiti at all? There's a whole process, a factory of people who are producing these signs. I mean, did you ever see it during the campaign?
Yes.
There's like
they hand them out
to people in the crowds. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you would be mistaken for thinking that all these people have been at home with their 6-year-old kid with a paintbrush and gone, I love Bush, like this. But in fact, they're made en masse. I found that, I photographed that. I found it fascinating that you know, the people are told, write like a 4-year-old, you know, with your paintbrush. So, you know, that kind of thing, yeah, controlled.
Uh-huh. One more question, Towson.
I had a question for Charles. Since you said you came in blind to the American political system, I was wondering what you've learned about it and what you think the most positive aspects are and the most negative aspects.
Gosh.
You got a good job.
I think the positive aspects are obviously that people are genuinely interested in the process all across the country. I mean, I think, you know, where I'm from in Great Britain, people are very complacent and can't be bothered. And, you know, consequently, it breeds kind of a political laziness in England. We're like, oh, you know, our campaigns are, the campaign for the Prime Minister is 2 to 3 months long. Really, you know, I always enjoyed, for instance, you know, when you go to Eastern Europe, how involved people were in the political process. You know, you'd go to a cafe and you'd find 20 people sitting around drinking espresso talking about politics, and that never happened in England, certainly not for me growing up. And I think, you know, one of the positive things with with watching America in the election, people, I think people just taking a genuine interest in who their leader essentially is going to be. I mean, I think that's got to be positive. Negative. Negative only generally for me comes from myself, and it's like I'll be the negative aspects. Gosh, they're kind of like they're all usually things to do with myself. You know, they're usually I'm tired and I'm sick to death of hearing the same speech, and you know I become very cynical and.
The repetitive and controlled nature
of it. You know, you become kind of. You can become quite cynical and unpleasant, and that's the only really negative side of doing this. You know, I can see. I don't know if you would agree. I mean, going back to the initial part of your question, though, coming from Europe, I think worked in my favor because I think I woke up every morning, and I would go to bed every night. Having seen something that perhaps, if you'd grown up with this whole process, you would have just like not even noticed. You wouldn't have batted an eyelid. And Newsweek used to say to me that they used to find my pictures very funny because I would see things that I found hysterical, you know, mm-hmm. that could be anything, you know, someone's diamond brooch. But I would find that very, you know, I'd find that it would all be new to me. And I think, you know, That was one of the reasons, my motivating forces for being involved in this in any way at all. Mm-hmm. Does that kind of answer your question at all?
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much. We appreciate both of you coming for this last session. It was a very, very good one.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Okay.